Good morning. Can you all hear me with this thing?
Yes.
So I don't have to love it. All right. So I'm going to talk about Easebird, and we can all sing the song changes, but you don't want to hear me sing. Because one of the things about software is that it is always changing. It's always getting new capabilities. And why is it doing this? Well, because people call me and say, this didn't work. Or because we have new science to say, this should be the way we do this, not this. Or because we change the project and we can change the rules that we are using. So there are a variety of reasons why the software is always changing. And so we're going to talk about some of the changes that we have done, or some of the changes that are going to happen. All right. So the first thing, which I think will be everyone's favorite change, is that we're going to be limiting the GIP requests at the end of the grant. So that's the end of September. This is about 150 questions that you won't have to answer, and that you won't be able to answer anymore. I apologize if you really liked those questions. We're also removing an assessment, the attitude assessment, which was used for the evaluation. We're not going to be using that anymore. And we're removing the reminder and tracking form, because no longer will we be following patients for 6 months afterwards. So the number of assessments, the number of questions is going to shrink dramatically. But that's going to be only on a few of the patients, because most of those questions were only asked for patients who were going to get a brief coaching or referral for treatment. So when they're just getting a brief education, there's a much briefer set of questions. They won't have quite as many, but they never answered those 150 questions. The second thing we're doing is we're going to improve the pre-screening. So what is screening? Basically, pre-screening is trying to figure out which patients we should ask for questions of and which we can safely assume are fine and we don't need to ask anymore. That's what pre-screening is. And the nice thing about pre-screening is there are two ways to be right. Anytime you can do something where there are two ways to be right, that's really great. So we can be right by saying someone needs screening, and we can be right by saying someone doesn't need screening who doesn't need screening. Now, the nasty downside of that is that there are also two ways to be wrong. So we can be wrong by saying someone needs screening when they really don't, which wastes your time and their time. And we can be wrong by saying someone doesn't need screening when they really do. So we're missing an opportunity to provide that person with needed services. So this is the original screening that we used. It used questions from the NIAAA, used questions from the CAGE, talked about smoking pot or using street drugs or using medications inappropriately. It asked those kinds of questions. Now the problem with what happened, and so people started saying, my pre-screens are coming positive for people who really don't have problems, and I'm having to ask these other questions too often. You were getting too many false positives. So what were the problems? We went in and started looking at the question of how the pre-screening was occurring. The first problem we identified with the pre-screening is that there are not any appropriate norms for the kinds of questions we are asking. What we are trying to decide with our pre-screening is someone going to have a positive screening on the assist? Most of the norms, actually all of the norms I can find for any assessment, deal with whether or not the person is addicted or dependent. Which is really not the people that we're focused on in Escort. We really are focused on the people who are risky users, before they get to the stage of addiction and dependence. So that 20% of people who are drinking a six-pack of beer Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, because everybody drinks a six-pack of beer Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, they're not an alcoholic. They don't have those kinds of difficulties. But the norms that we had available to us really were not good enough to tell us what was happening. So when we looked at our screens, we saw that in fact we were doing a shitty job, excuse the clinical expression, of identifying successfully, or pre-screening successfully, who was going to need more screening, who was going to need the assist. So our sensitivity was 44%, so we were identifying 44% of the people who needed an assist, who were going to have a problem. But we were, our specificity, the people who were negative, we were only getting 12% of those folks, which means that you were assessing 88% more than you needed to, which, if I were you, would be a little irritating. So we looked at a revised screen and did some pilot testing with that. And what we're able to show in that revised screen is that we can increase sensitivity to 80% and specificity, the ability to not ask these questions of people who don't need it, to 71%, both of which are really good kind of numbers to have for pre-screening. So one of the things we're going to do is to change the pre-screen, to make it so that you do not have to ask questions of people who don't need it. So the new pre-screening questions are these, and they are the audit C, for those of you that are familiar with the audit. These are the consumption questions from the audit, which is a commonly used screen. In addition to the questions on drug and tobacco use that we already ask. Now, you all have spent time and money putting the pre-screen, the current pre-screen, into your EMRs. So you're going to say, I can't do that, we weren't out of here. So we're going to do two things. One, there's going to be a checkbox on the pre-screen in Eastbrook that says, I got a positive screen somewhere else, and you can just go ahead from that point. The other is that you could do the second pre-screen, this new pre-screen in Eastbrook, and eliminate talking to some of the people who you really are not going to need to talk to, because the pre-screen, the new pre-screen, is going to be so much more effective at identifying who you should be talking to than the old one. That choice is up to you. Any questions about the pre-screen?
Can you run that by again? I didn't catch it all. What were the options?
The options on the pre-screen in Eastworth, there will be a checkbox that says, I had a positive pre-screen elsewhere, and that's the only thing you have to mark, and then you can go on and do the assist. Or you can answer the new pre-screen questions, and that will tell you whether or not you have to go on to do the assist. If you do those, if you ask those extra three questions, you'll reduce the number of times you have to ask the other questions that you'll have to talk to people. So you won't irritate the folks, you won't spend your time doing things you don't need to do. It's probably actually better to ask those additional questions, but it's really up to you to make that decision.
Just so that I have this correctly and straight in my own mind, so the three screens that we already have in place on the EMR, we ask additional questions?
We are replacing replacing those in each version.
Okay, so IT
firms
go in and replace those questions.
They could.
Or they could
do this.
Okay.
Or you do this. So I'm not requiring that.
Sure.
That's up to you all. You know, that's getting IT people to do things. I know we try to be really recalcitrant and say how hard it's going to be. We're like Scotty. You know, it's always going to take a year and $100,000 to change this one question.
One question. We have developed a connection for our FQHCs. We have actually developed connectors from their EHR for those questions to the Drives database where we're recording onto the state. So my question is, how this, obviously, this is going to have an impact on how we develop those mappings and connections to the questions that are already answering for the pre-screening.
Right. We are not changing or not recommending or suggesting or insisting or anything that those questions in the EMR be changed. They could be changed if you all decide to do that, but that's not something we are saying that has to be done. Because those connections are already there and they're used, and you can continue to use them because that's still in the EMR.
So for the people putting the information in, they can still continue to use their templates as they are in the HR, but they're going to have to go to eSBIRT and either pick one of these options.
They choose either to say, we did it in the EMR and it's positive, and go forward, or answer some additional questions. The purpose of this really was to work with folks and to try to meet the problems that you had identified, one of which is that you were assessing people who did not really seem to need to be assessed.
So if we go with the first option, then we're likely to be in the same boat we were before, assessing people that needed to be assessed.
If you go with the first option, you will be in the same boat you were in before, assessing people who don't necessarily need to be assessed. Yeah. But you get the choice. I don't care. So the second area of change is in the personal feedback report. Now, one of the things that you all do frequently is to give patients information about variety disorders, about lifestyle choices, about how they can lower their blood sugar or how they can exercise. You have pamphlets and handouts and there's stuff on the website that you've done for those other sites that you all have created that you've shared. So that's one of the things that's really important. In eSBIRT, what you have is a system that creates a personalized version of that for each individual. It's tailored to their particular needs based on their sex, based on normative information, based on how they responded to those questions. So it's a very structured, straightforward way to give that individual feedback. Now, why is this important? It's important because there is a lot of research that shows that simply providing people with this kind of a report, with this structured feedback that is tailored to their particular situation, has their name all over it, is effective in and of itself in reducing their risky substance use. There's just a plethora of research studies to support this. So if you do nothing else, giving this report to the patients is going to help at least some of them change their behaviors.
So that's the reason we put a lot of emphasis on this personal feedback report.
So it starts off, and I'm going to go through some of the sections just briefly at this point. It starts off describing the report to the patient. It is personalized. Matthew, this most men talk about, so it's based on me and my sex and my choices. Talks about those things. It compares your risk level. So for any substance that is indicated in the assist to be risky use, you'll get one of these bars that will show the patient where it is they stand in terms of risk. We only show these for people who are at risk. So there's a, I don't know whether there are 8 or 9 different substances in the assist. You only see this, and it only gives the recommendations for these things for the people who, for the areas in which they have risk. It talks about each of those things specifically. It is very extensive in terms of alcohol, because alcohol is the most frequently abused substance in those 100,000 patients that we have screened. So it talks a lot about alcohol, and there's a lot of research about alcohol. But it talks about how many drinks they've had, how much this cost them, how many calories they gained by the number of drinks, and how much they have to exercise to burn those calories off. And they, again, this is all specific to that particular individual. And that talks about their individual risks. It talks also to them about what they can do based on their readiness to change. So one of the questions that you're asking when you're doing the Easberg process is where they are in terms of how ready they are to change. Because giving someone who does not think that they have a problem a suggestion that they, you know, drop all of their friends, quit going to bars, whatever it is that might be, as if they are in the action stage, is really a waste of your time and theirs. So the suggestions for those people in the pre-contemplation stage really are designed to help them think about, now that they know about these risks, you know, what do they think about this? So it really helps you in your motivational interviewing with these individuals to help them think about where they are now, where they might like to be, and how they might like to make those changes. One of the new things that we've added is a drink comparison. There's some really interesting literature that showed that this one chart alone reduced alcohol consumption. So we asked the patient, how much do you drink each week and each time you drink? And how much do you think that other people drink in those same time periods? We then use this chart to dynamically compare their use, what they think other people are doing, and what, in fact, people in Missouri and the United States, based on their age and sex, are actually drinking. So this report says, on days you drink, you have 8 drinks, and you estimate that others have 10 drinks, so I'm only drinking 8. Other people always drink 10. I'm much better than they are. But in fact, the average male your age drinks less than 4. So it really helps them frame their current behaviors in a broader context and to think about it. And there's some really nice literature to suggest that this alone will reduce their level, comparing them with other folks. We've added to the reports things we call action blocks. These are yellow blocks that stand out in the text, and they all give specific kind of recommendations for what the individual might do. So this particular one talks about pacing and spacing of drinks and how they might do that, or keeping track of how much they drink. So these are all behavioral recommendations. They're set out in the report in these highlighted yellow action blocks. Some of the other things that we're doing currently is we are editing the report for using plain language. Now, it's currently written at a 6th grade level. But plain language really is different than that. And it really seeks to make the report as understandable as possible and as impactful as possible by making the terms and the words and the descriptions straightforward, objective, and easy for everybody to understand. Because one of the things that you may notice with your patients is that when you talk to them, they don't remember what you said, they don't understand what you said. Well, and if you think about going to the doctor yourself, what percentage of what they are saying do you always remember? And all of us have exactly that same kind of problem. It's just hard. It's a stressful situation. They're running through trying to tell you stuff quickly, and they're trying to pick up on this. So this plain language editing is going to make this easier for people to understand and appreciate. When that's done, we're getting the whole thing translated into Spanish. So currently the questions are all available in Spanish, but the PFR is not. So once we get the plain language done, we'll translate that all into Spanish, so the report will be available in both Spanish and English.
And the last thing we've already done is personalization. There's some interesting literature that suggests that if you put a person's name in a report six or more times, they find that report more impactful. It seemed like a really odd kind of finding, or kind of, you know, there was this one number. So, but people's names are in the report more than six times. So that it really is clearly about them. So I sent out an email asking for questions that folks had. And I got some questions. Well, I got one question. Why doesn't Easebird allow for date-based searching? Well, in fact, Easebird does allow for date-based searching. And by this question, what I took it to mean was that it was really unclear how this process worked. So we're going to step through that. So on the search bar at the top, on the right-hand side, you'll see something that's a drop-down box and a couple of date fields. That's the date-specific searching. You can drop down the box and you have a choice of show me everybody today, in the past week, in the past 2 weeks, in the past month, or all of the people. This date in the past today would be people that you pre-screened today. That's what the date is referring to, is when they are being screened. If you have other dates that you want, the fields on the right are date fields. You can type in a date. You can use a date selection box, a calendar selection box, to open it up and pick the dates that you want. So it'll search for any of those date ranges, giving you all the patients, or if you put in patient-specific information, I want, you know, John Smith, who I saw in March. You can enter that here and see John Smith in March. So that was the one question I got. Do you all have questions? Because the only way Easebird gets better is for people to say, why does it do this, or why doesn't it do that, or could it do this, or I have trouble with this. So do you all have any questions about Easebird, or suggestions or problems that you'd like to bring up? There. And what's your question?
I've had this come up a couple times.
No, we're good. Right.
So a couple of times with patients, the questions have to match. So they'll say, like, how many times have you been using alcohol? And then when you go through the bottom part, they have to match. The answers have to match. Well, patients don't always have the exact numbers, and they don't always match. So I had someone who used several different substances, and the numbers didn't match, and I had to spend, like, 30 minutes trying to sort out the numbers because the patient didn't know the exact answer. So I don't really see that that's really, really important for those numbers to match perfectly, because people don't actually collect data on their use.
Okay, that question is part of the GIPRA-B. That is a requirement from the federal government, and that goes away. How's that for fixing that problem?
Yeah.
Okay? All right. Any problem I can fix like that, I'm happy. Next question.
I guess with this one, the problem, which I think you'll have to fix it when the GIPRA goes away, which is just how long it takes to, once, for people who have used very much, and have much of a history, it just gets huge. You can't, it really makes the, you have to cancel appointments before or after, reschedule with them. I mean, it's enough.
Yes. So we've got 150 questions. And the people who have used a lot, they're the ones who are going to have those 150 questions have to be answered. So that's all gone, or will be gone in October.
You probably answered this when you were talking before, but I missed it. When is the change going to come about for the new screening, that the questions will be changed? Or we'll have to go in and put that checkbox?
So one of the things that we have to do in this new, with the new screening, is we have to be able to determine an appropriate cutoff based on our gold standard, which is going to be a positive or negative assist. We are currently collecting data with our old MoseBox system that's going to allow us to do that. So that'll be finished in September. We'll do the analysis. So we're probably talking about late October, something of that sort. We'll put an announcement out when that happens. But that's my guess. So that, because we need that study to be finished so that we can determine what the appropriate cutoffs are, because there is nothing in the literature that we can really go by to determine what the cutoffs are for a positive assist. So that's the best I can do for that. Yes?
The flat files from the university, the PCCs that are in here, and the FQHCs that are in this project. We're going to need to go back and look how this will work and impact in drives and that data flow. So we'll probably be calling you to set up a meeting to see how that's going to work. And we'll get back to the rest of you on it.
Anybody else? We have more dollars.
No, when Ron was doing the Eastburg, one of the patients that I was doing it on, it came up that they needed intervention treatment, and that it would have a date for the end of treatment on there. And I was like, well, I'm not giving you the treatment, and it's long term. If they needed more than just a, you know, an education on my part, they needed to go to actual treatment. How would we document that?
If you are, so there was this a brief coaching service, or did they need referral?
They needed referral, but on the referral, it wanted an end date of their treatment. And I can't remember specifically what page it was. It was one of the last.
That may have been discharging.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
for the referrals, there is a place in there to record what you have done, the activities that you've done, and whether or not that activity reached, whether the patient reached the referral site. At some point, you're going to, and so you just enter those. There are a bunch of options, and you just add as many of those activities as you want.
Okay.
When you're getting to the discharge, at some point, you're going to discharge them and not see them. So that's whatever your discharge date. That's not the end of their treatment. You referred them.
Okay.
So that's the end of your service.
Okay. So
not the end of their service.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That makes sense.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you all.